This is Danielle Fishel.
And Ryder Strong from Pod Meets World.
When you have 5 and 7-year-old boys, I can promise you they love superheroes.
Oh, it never goes away. Indy is 11 years old and he's obsessed with comics, cartoons, video games, all of it.
Adler and Keaton both have Spider-Man costumes, and if anything says Marvel on it, they are in.
Same. Which is why we love Lingo Kids. They have Marvel Spider-Man activities that are totally age-appropriate.
And safe. Made just for the little ones.
Plus, Disney's Moana, Frozen, Zootopia, all the characters your kids already love, and a few you're secretly hoping they'll get into.
I just load up the iPads with Lingo Kids before a trip, and with over 4,000 interactive activities, songs, and shows, it keeps their attention for hours.
Download Lingo Kids for free or go all in with Lingo Kids Plus for even more incredible content.
Choose the yearly plan and save up to 60%. Search Lingo Kids in the App Store or Google Play.
Lingo Kids, everything kids love.
Hi, everyone. We have a special announcement before we begin this week's episode. Have you ever wished that you could walk around a city and be given a private, intimate tour whispered into your ears in a sultry tone by a celebrity expert guide?
All the time. Yeah.
Well, that dream is now a reality if you're visiting London. Ooh. Because QI has teamed up with VoiceMap, a brilliant self-guided tour app, to bring you the first quite interesting tours, packed full of our trademark unusual facts.
And narrated by none other than Mr. QI himself, Sir Stephen Fry.
Whoa. Yeah. You simply download the app from the Apple Store or Google Play, select your tour, stick your headphones in, and get walking.
It's really easy to use. You can put your phone away because VoiceMap monitors your location as you're on the move, and it plays audio to you automatically as you arrive at each location. So it's great. You don't need to check your phone the whole time.
You can do it whenever you like, and like start whenever, stop, have a drink. Halfway through.
Do it at 3 a.m. if you're interested.
Creepy.
We've got good streetlights here in London, so you'll be able to see everything. We've put 2 London tours together so far, one of Westminster and one of the City and Bankside.
That's right. So whether you're a first-time visitor to London or a lifetime local, you can take directions from Stephen and see the city from a whole new perspective. For example, did you know that
London is home to over 8.4 million trees, covering 21% of the city. This means that by the UN's standards, it can officially be classified as a forest.
That's so cool. I didn't know that.
I feel so healthy now.
Yeah. Or did you know that our most famous landmark, Big Ben,
keeps accurate time with the help of a handful of pre-decimal coins? A single penny balanced on the pendulum can speed the clock up by 2/5 of a second.
Who uses cash these days?
Yeah, only our clocks.
Well, yeah, only our clocks. That's where it all is.
You might discover how
London's classic red phone boxes were actually based on a tomb.
Oh, they creepy. Do look quite like a tomb, actually.
So, what's not to love? To get started, just visit qi.com/voicemap.
If you're not going to be in London anytime soon, you can still get involved. You can listen to the tours virtually, just like a podcast or audiobook.
But before you crack into that, make sure you enjoy this week's episode of Lunchbox Envy.
Hey. This week on Lunchbox Envy, it provides the human race with over 20% of its calories.
It comes in over 132,000 varieties, and the Great Wall of China is cemented together with it.
It's rice. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Manu. Hey, Manu.
Hello, how are you doing?
Excellent, thank you.
We are also joined by food writer and chef, Rosie McKean. Hi, Rosie.
Hello.
Hello.
So, rice.
I actually do absolutely adore rice. It's a real comfort food for me. Buttered rice, mayonnaise on rice.
No way. Oh, you are a mayo fiend.
I'm unfortunately a mayo addict.
American comedian Mitch Hedberg said once, rice is great if you're hungry and want to eat 5,000 or something.
Nice.
But the numbers are boggling. Like, it's the main staple for 4 billion people, so half the world.
Wow.
And it provides, as I said in the intro, humans with 20% of their calories, which is more than wheat or maize, actually. But you think about the amount of wheat we eat in Europe particularly. Mm-hmm. And that's astonishing. Approximately 25.5 trillion grains of rice are produced globally every year. which is just a mind-boggling. I mean, it's a big number.
I was going to say, I can't picture that at
no,
all.
It's so I also big. Don't know how you even count that. Like, how do you know that's happening?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I guess you know the tonnage that goes through global trade, and then you can work out mm-hmm. how many grains are in a ton on average.
Yeah, some poor bugger has had yeah. to count that out one time.
No, legit. So one of the facts that came up in this research was that there are 10,000 grains of uncooked rice in a 200-gram cup.
Oh, wow.
And I read that and I was like, that's not true. So I looked it up.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say. I thought I've you watched, counted it. You did it yourself.
No, I've watched videos oh, of really? People counting out rice grains, and it's true. It's Stop. Mad. So many grains in like such a tiny space.
Yeah. What about, do they count ones that have broken?
Oh,
oh
good
no, I must, think it's whole.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, he had tweezers, the guy I watched. It's like,
yeah, mages. Well, you'd need it. You would get so bored doing that. Oh my
Slow
God.
TV,
you couldn't pay
right?
me enough money.
Maybe it'd be meditative.
No, yeah, actually, you could pay me enough
yeah,
money.
Yeah, a pound per
roughly
grain.
£20,000.
Nice.
I'd do it for 10, if you're listening, Rice.
Stop. Stop under fucking cutting me every time.
Rice cultivation, it's quite resource intensive in certain ways. So it uses 40% of the world's irrigation water. Ooh. Which is because it's quite a thirsty plant. Although we'll come to that later, it doesn't actually drink most of the water. And we think it comes from, I mean, China, India and Thailand all claim ownership of it, as in like the origins of rice. So we think somewhere around that part of the world. But yeah, basically all the rice we eat today comes from Asian varieties. So you said in the intro, 132,000 varieties. How many of them do we cultivate? How many of them are edible?
A whole 40,000.
Wow, that's quite a big percentage.
I know, it's absolutely mad.
There aren't that many varieties of wheat or maize or pretty much any plant. There are various grain banks.
Mm-hmm.
Ricepedia is a website, a fascinating website I found, which has...
What? I didn't find that. Yeah. Ricepedia?
Yeah. To be fair, I didn't read all of their entries, but they have basically every sort of textbook scientific paper that has ever been written about rice varieties, because everyone's so desperate to get these crossbreeds that create the greatest yields or like need the least water, and Ricepedia seems to be the place for it.
Now, there's also the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, which acts as a massive rice gene bank. So they got loads of seed samples.
Mm.
They have over 130,000 different varieties,
oh, wow.
like physically there as well,
wow.
which is so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they're really important in developing rice varieties that were better at withstanding like climate shifts and stuff. So they're playing a really important role in keeping the plant alive.
Good.
I know.
And how many can you get in Sainsbury's?
about five.
Yeah, exactly.
Not very many.
We should diversify.
We should, really.
I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that the world's most expensive rice is a short grain rice produced in Japan called kinamai?
Mm-hmm.
And it will cost you $120 for a 140-gram pack.
Whoa. Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. I'd love to try it and see if I could tell the difference between my normal Japanese rice.
That's almost $1 per gram.
Yeah.
Oh, damn.
Have you had Camargue red rice?
Yes.
That's Ooh. Probably the most exotic rice I've had.
I feel I'm really not into the coloured rices.
Really? No?
Sorry, that sounds racist. Racist.
Rices of colour.
Oh, wow.
That's racist. But like, generally speaking, I often find that they can be more difficult to cook, basically.
Mm.
They taste too nutty, like too sort of brittle almost. Mm-hmm. I'm just honestly not a fan.
No,
I've got to be honest. I've got to be true to myself. I like it white.
Oh, God.
This is horrible. This is a horrible soundbite.
Keeping it.
Alex, the producer, is shaking his head and looking very, very sad.
Okay, let's get a move on. Should we crack into our first lunchbox?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. So our first lunchbox is Rosie's.
And do you know what? Unlike me, I've actually managed to put it in the lunchbox today.
Amazing.
Rosie, well done.
I know.
Very
I brought
fluid.
Some rice pudding.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
We don't really have culturally a good relationship with rice dishes, but this one we do. So
nice.
I'm going to give you some rice pudding with some jam.
My mum learned to cook from her Gujarati mother-in-law.
Uh-huh.
She used to make the Gujarati version, which had like loads of elachi or like cardamom in it.
Ooh. Is that called kheer?
But potentially, I'm not sure. We just called it rice pudding. We're going to have a little
Oh,
bit.
Wow. Is this your own recipe?
Yeah, this is a recipe I wrote for Delicious magazine recently, actually.
Mm. Well, it is delicious.
It's a very comforting dish, rice pudding. Mm. We would maybe think of rice pudding served this way with jam, very simply done with vanilla in it, as quite typically British. It is, of course, not. and it seems likely that sort of all of the rice, the early rice pudding versions that we've seen were inspired by either Arab dishes or Indian dishes like kheer. Mm. But it's not really, it's not, you can't really tell where we got the idea from, mm-hmm. but it's probably from there. Mm-hmm. So the very first recipe found of rice pudding in early British food chronicling was in a collection of recipes called The Form of Curry. From the 1390s.
Oh, wait, curry is in like curry.
So there were two recipes for rice, a rice pudding base dish in this collection of recipes. Mm. One was the a rice pottage, basically. Very simple. And then one was called Rice of the Flesh.
Oh, God.
Rice spelled R-Y-S-E.
Yeah, spelling was all over the place.
And Rice of the Flesh was actually savory, made with broth, beef broth, almond milk, and saffron and salt. Mm. And the rice pottage was just very simple rice cooked with water, no sugar. So I guess both of them are kind of more like a risotto, or in the case of the rice pottage, more like a congee, which is an Asian rice dish where rice is cooked and cooked and cooked for a very long time.
It's like a porridge.
In water, like until it is porridge consistency. The rice is essentially very overcooked at the end.
Both of those dishes sound so bad.
Oh, they sound terrible.
Like, why? Why have you done this?
Because they did all sorts of crazy shit back then. You know, nowadays, we would say that rice pudding is quite a humble dish, especially in the 20th century. This was a real school food, right? Mm. School dinner.
Mm. Yeah, it's got a horrible connotation.
Yeah, so. You'd always have it at school for dinner. Mm. And it's worth noting, really, that this dish started out as a very high-level kings and queens aristocratic dish because rice was really expensive. The main ingredients in modern rice pudding recipes now in the UK are rice and milk. Mm-hmm. Importantly, short-grain rice, not long-grain rice.
Okay. Why is that?
So, well, long-grain rice has less starch.
When is it important to have starch, or do we want to get rid of it most of the time or only sometimes?
Right. So, well, I think maybe we should just explain what the starch is. So starch is a complex carbohydrate that is present in all grains.
Okay.
Okay. So we talked quite a lot about it in the pasta episode, about the presence of the starch in the pasta, which is created from the wheat and the flour that's used to make it, and how important that is in emulsifying sauces, because when starch comes into contact with water, starch starts as like a powder or, you know, a solid, basically. And then when it comes into contact with water, it gelatinizes and becomes a thick, gloopy substance. So if you're thinking about rice, ideally, most rice, apart from sticky, want to avoid anything gelatinous or sort of gloopy. Mm. Therefore, the less starch that there is in the water where you cook your rice, the less opportunity it has to gelatinize. So therefore, your rice grains won't stick together. They'll be nice and separate, and they will be dry and fluffy for the most part.
Lovely.
So it doesn't perform in the same way. It's drier. Mm. Mm. You can make rice pudding with long grain rice, but it won't be as supple, and the grains won't hold as well because the shorter grains basically cook more evenly, right?
Okay,
because they don't have those long, brittle points.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they hold their shape better. This is my version. It's basically a hybrid of sort of two versions. So you can either cook rice pudding only on the hob and you just stir and stir and stir and it cooks for like nearly an hour. Yeah. That's because you're cooking with milk, which can burn quite easily. So you need to make sure the temperature is low. And also the rice takes a long time when it's not being cooked in water,
right?
Because milk is much thicker than water. The osmosis takes a lot longer for it to soak in all the liquid. It just takes longer. Mm. It's just a long thing. Just like, don't try and do it quickly. It's not supposed to be done quickly. Or you can bake it in the oven, taking it out and stirring it every so often. Ooh. And then there are sort of different schools of thought around this. Some people like it to get like a real dark golden skin.
Skin, yeah.
And the skin on rice pudding is supposed to be really, really delicious.
I'm pro-skin.
I'm anti-skin.
Skin of the flesh.
Oh, God.
And then you can do what I do, which is like a hybrid. You start it on the hob and then you put it in the oven. And I don't let it get a skin because I don't like the skin. And that's very personal. This is a very, very basic version with vanilla, sugar, butter, milk, and double cream. Mm. Previously, it has been spiced. And also, to even nowadays, you would find spice versions with cinnamon, nutmeg, bay is a delicious addition. You know, way back then, they'd use all sorts of wild shit. They'd probably put like mints in it. And I like it with jam. Another great way, which my friend Ben Lippitt introduced me to, he's a chef and food writer, is to make rice pudding, chill it down, and then brulee the top. So you put sugar on top like you would a creme brulee, blowtorch it or grill it. Gets a delicious crunchy top, soft, silky, cold rice pudding underneath. Oh, that's good stuff. That does sound good.
Yeah,
I think I just wanted to bring in a rice pudding because I just was like, this is the only really good example I can think of British people cooking rice well. We are not known for our rice cookery. That brought me on to sort of washing rice, controversial for some. Do you guys wash your rice?
My mum's Gujarati heritage, my dad's Mauritian. Both big, big rice eaters. I was raised in a, like, you wash your rice at least three times.
Yeah.
Get all of the starch off the outside. Beautiful, fluffy, like, cooked rice.
Mm-hmm.
Doing the research for this, what I've read, and why it makes the people angry, it doesn't matter unless you're actually trying to, like, rinse impurities off your rice, whether you wash it or not, because the type of rice is what's going to affect the starchiness more so than how much you wash it. So if you have a starchy variety, like a sticky rice, that is what's going to affect the gloop. I mean, obviously, if you overcook it, it's going to gloop. But like, you could not wash a long grain, drier, less starchy, say basmati style rice, and it would be fine.
I do see your point. And there's two, I think, ways to approach it. One is, yes, washing the impurities off is important. In the processing and manufacturing of rice, there is a ton of, like, you know, random bits of stone and, you know, all sorts of stuff that ends up in the bag of rice. And you don't have people picking that off the line, I can tell you that. So that's one, you know, very sort of like basic reason to wash rice. The other thing is that when rice is packed together, grains of rice, they rub each other. And the rubbing erodes a bit of that outer starch layer, which becomes a fine powder over the grain of the rice. Now that can be washed off if you want it to be really, really perfect.
Yeah.
And that is kind of an unavoidable side effect of the processing and large scale manufacturing of rice and packing it. You know, there is another method where you don't have to wash rice and you can get a nice, perfect, separate grain, which is toasting rice.
We like to toast. Life-changing finding out about toasting / frying rice beforehand.
Not putting it in the toaster, it all falls out the bottom, right?
That's just a you thing, Jack.
So toasting rice, basically...
To rice. Cheers.
Toasting the rice, it dries out the starch. Basically, and it creates a protective shell around the grain of rice. One thing, I don't know if this came up in your research, Manny, but like one thing that is very sure is that you shouldn't wash all rice. There are some types that are better to be washed, and there are some that shouldn't be washed at all. Mostly short grain rices, where the intention is to create something quite starchy.
Don't wash your sticky rice.
You don't want to wash your sticky rice. You don't want to wash your risotto rice. You don't want to wash your paella rice. Those rices need their starch. They need that to stay on top. But it is good to toast them, particularly risotto rice.
Oh, okay.
In risotto rice, the theory that I was taught
by
Italian chefs
is that when
you toast a risotto rice grain, let's say you do it, you can do it either dry in a pan, you can do it even in the oven in a tray, or you can do it in the fat of the pan where you've maybe already cooked an onion. That's kind of how I do it. I just do a one pan method with risotto. So I just do an onion, then I toast my rice, and then I start adding my liquids. When you toast a risotto rice grain, what happens is it creates this shell around the rice, the grain of rice, as I said.
Ah.
So what you end up with is a slow release starch method where you get this silky sauce gradually as you continually add more liquid and as you agitate it. So agitating the rice in risotto cookery is important. I know that there are some recipes where it's like, you don't need to touch the rice, but the stirring is what helps the starch on the surface of the grain of rice
to come off.
But it happens slowly, and it means that the inside of the rice stays intact, and you should at the end, in the perfect, perfect risotto, have a very perfect looking grain of rice. It's kind of like a sort of slow cooker method, basically. Okay. That's what the toasting does.
Do you use a risotto spoon?
With a hole in it?
Yeah.
No, I don't. I don't know what the theory is.
I've got one.
Oh, is my God. Can I see?
But why do they have a hole in it? I can't remember the reason why.
I've always looked at those spoons and been like, why?
The theory behind it is that you don't want to squish the grains against the edge of the pan.
Right.
But I don't think anyone's stirring that vigorously. I certainly don't.
There are some recipes where they say that you should only stir risotto in the same direction.
Yes.
So if you start clockwise, you shouldn't go anti-clockwise.
I think this is a left-handed one because the corner, you see there's a corner, yeah, yeah, and an edge that gets right into the edge.
It's really diverse of them to have picked that.
What's the phrase? It's anti-clockwise.
Yes.
Seems like wrong, I'm afraid.
I feel like someone fucked up when they were whittling a spoon one time. And they were like, no, this is for risotto. One of the things I love about conversations about cooking rice is everyone gets so emotional about it.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I still, as a professional chef, cannot always cook rice well.
Really?
Like, I still fuck it up.
I'm feeling like there is no right way. And at the heart of it, it's just like luck and witchcraft, I think. One of the things we haven't spoken about is rice cookers.
Yeah. Oh my God. I love my rice cooker.
Right, you have one?
Yeah. I got given one for Christmas this year.
Is it?
I've been begging for one.
Yeah. Is it actually a game changer?
Oh, it's heaven. Mm-hmm. It's honestly heaven. There is, I think, a bit of a common thought in chefs is that they don't need gizmos and gadgets to cook stuff, right? Like, we can just do it all by scratch.
Our garlic crusher comments got so much controversy
but this is so different.
This is so, so different. This... My rice cooker uses AI to help it cook
You
rice.
Have an AI rice cooker? I've read about these and I was like, who has this?
And it's mysteriously explained. It's something like, and special AI technology to check that it's cooking the rice perfectly or something
What I read is there's a Japanese company called Zujirushi.
That's the most expensive one, right?
Yeah, that is.
I don't have that
one. Oh, okay. Basically, the rice cooker collects data on your rice and how it's cooking, and it feeds back to the machine, and then the AI bit's like, oh, how can we improve this, like minute kind of steaming. And
it's honestly been such a life-changing thing to have. You can leave your air fryers in the bin. I'm a rice cooker girl through and through. I can put my rice on, put it on a delay start, and it won't cook until I want it to cook, and then it will hold it hot for me at a safe temperature without overcooking it for like 5 hours.
Wow.
It's literally genius. And like, I've fallen quite deeply into a hole of Korean cafeteria TikTok where I like to watch Korean people getting their lunch in their office.
I've watched some of
these. They're so good. They're absolutely amazing.
They must be the most healthy population. Like the variety of food and vegetables.
They have these absolutely vast, like, half the size of me rice cookers where people get their scoops of rice, and they've obviously, you know, cooked probably like 3, 4, 5 kilos of rice perfectly.
Wow.
And it's just like, what a genius bit of kit.
Yeah.
It's really interesting reading about the history of how these came about. So it kind of started like a kind of arms race or space race in Japan, like companies vying to make the best rice cooker. Mm. So Toshiba made its first one in 1955. Mm-hmm. And within a year, it was producing about 200,000 a month. Like the demand was so high. Today, 89% of Japanese households have a rice cooker. So they're all over the place. Mm. It's so cool how it works. It basically just has a temperature sensor and it knows when the rice has gotten to temperature, and that if you've gotten the proportions right, the water will be gone. And then, as you said, it can hold it at a kind of warm, safe temperature for a really long time, and you can just go off and do your thing.
The best thing you'll ever buy.
Mm-hmm.
I should have really finished my whole spiel about how I cook rice with, and now I just have a rice cooker, so it doesn't matter.
This is Danielle Fishel
and Ryder Strong from Pod Meets World.
When you have 5 and 7 year old boys, I can promise you they love superheroes.
Oh, it never goes away. Indy is 11 years old and he's obsessed with comics, cartoons, video games, all of it.
Adler and Keaton both have Spider-Man costumes, and if anything says Marvel on it, they are in.
Same. Which is why we love Lingo Kids. They have Marvel Spider-Man activities that are totally age-appropriate.
And safe. Made just for the little ones.
Plus, Disney's Moana, Frozen, Zootopia, all the characters your kids already love, and a few you're secretly hoping they'll get into.
I just load up the iPads with Lingo Kids before a trip, and with over 4,000 interactive activities, songs, and shows, it keeps their attention for hours.
Download Lingo Kids for free or go all in with Lingo Kids Plus for even more incredible content.
Choose the yearly plan and save up to 60%. Search Lingo Kids in the App Store or Google Play.
Lingo Kids, everything kids love.
Let's move on to our second lunchbox, and that's yours, Manny.
So I have...
Oh, it's a bit small.
Looking very suspicious.
I know. I have brought today a few grains of rice, two of which have a tiny message on it.
No way.
I know. Do you want to have a look and see if you can read it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So...
Oh, my God.
I know.
How did you do this?
Oh, so wow. I got, you know, like the really fine eyeliner pens?
Yeah.
I scribbled a message on two grains of rice. So, Jack, you have one that says...
Lunch.
Rosie?
Box.
Woo!
I'm so impressed with your writing with an eyeliner pen. You're That's fine. Not easy.
Thank you. So it's legible, tiny, tiny writing on some grains of rice. This is a very, very unsophisticated version of what I'm about to talk about. So this was inspired by... a Chinese folk craft, which is engraving super tiny messages or pictures on a single grain of rice. So it's thought to have begun in the Qing dynasty, so between 1644 and 1911/12.
Right.
Particularly with bureaucrats that had been working under the Qianlong Emperor in the 1700s, because we think that they used to use this engraving technique to cheat in exams.
Oh, wow.
I know.
I was just thinking of the practical applications.
Yeah.
So whether it was just, I mean, the point of it was presumably just to show off your skill.
Exactly. Yeah. So getting something like so tiny and so detailed, especially at that time, would have been really impressive. But it actually did have a practical use, we think, because of the longevity of rice. I haven't been able to find examples specifically of like the cheat sheets on a rice grain because, as we know, rice does fall apart. But I have been able to find other examples of bureaucrats cheating in this time period. So in the Jiangnan Imperial Museum in Nanjing, they've got an example of a similar kind of writing on socks. So I'm showing the guys an image of a pair of socks just... covered in loads of tiny characters. So yeah, they got really, really inventive because there were so many exams to like stay in the bureaucratic system at this point. There's so much to remember. So they developed all of these crazy, crazy techniques. But what's really nice is that rice carving is still practiced today by rice carving artists, and they use engraving pens that are not that much wider than the width of a human hair. So they're about 0.25 millimeters. They're super, super small.
God, I thought I'd do well when I use my back of my earring to get my SIM card out of my phone. I was like, God, I'm good.
it is satisfying though, isn't it? But yeah, it's super cool. And they often do their drawing under a microscope. So they'll have their hands like under the microscope looking into it. And when they're actually engraving the grain of rice, they'll hold their breath so they don't move. So there's one artist who's in his 80s who's called Chen Jingyuan, and he can fit upwards of 204 characters on one grain of rice.
Oh my god.
It's actually quite popular on Etsy now, so you can get little single grains of rice with like your name written on it.
Did they use it? Do you remember when Jack did the egg with the disappearing messages? Do you think they would have ever used it to pass messages in like prisons, that kind of thing?
I mean, I'm not sure they would have had the tools to the tiny engraving of prisons, but we think ninjas might have used rice to communicate secretly exactly in that way. But instead of engravings, they dyed individual rice grains different colors.
Okay.
So there were five colors, purple, black, red, yellow, and blue. And what they do is arrange the rice grains in a specific order that represented a character, kind of like Morse code. Then they'd lay those characters out on the ground outside in specific secret areas where other ninjas could go and read them. But obviously, because it's an organic material and it's outside, it's not going to last very long, so it's untraceable.
Yeah, you'd be a ninja walking along and then you see this message that says two men, 10 o'clock. Red hat written in rice? No? Anyone?
Yeah, I'll take it.
Dogging ninjas.
No, because they were their targets, okay, not there okay, for their okay. dogging. Why do you always have to go to the gutter?
What is really fun is we think that the dyes that they used on the rice also tasted really bad to stop birds from eating them.
Oh, that's clever.
Very clever. Yeah, because that was going to be my next question.
So yeah, that was my little lunchbox.
I love
for
that
today.
Classic rice providing a service for everyone in different ways all the time.
Yeah. But it's what is really cool is in our research for QI, I found the opposite was also the case. So rice in art can be done on a massive scale. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I found out for QI was that the snowiest city in the world is Amori in Japan. Mm-hmm. So not what you'd expect. But another thing that the city is really famous for is rice paddy art. So they'll use all of the different rice grain varieties, so because they come in loads of different colours, and plant them in shapes, kind of like crop circles.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, they'll do stuff like the Mona Lisa or Godzilla.
And they grow.
Yeah, so when they grow, they'll grow into these incredible pieces of art that you can only view from like aerial.
Right.
So flying above them, they're massive.
Amazing.
So like crop circles, but not made by aliens.
That we know of.
Just whilst we're talking about rice and language, another thing that I found out that is so wholesome is because rice is such an important part of so many different cultures. There are a lot of particularly Asian languages where it's become a greeting. So in Thai, Korean, and Mandarin, you ask, have you had rice? As a like, oh, how are you doing? Like, have you eaten yet?
Yeah.
Oh. Which is really nice.
What would we do for the UK?
Have you had your tea yet?
Oh,
yeah.
I like that.
Or me, have you had a giant spoonful of mayonnaise?
Well, my first one, yeah.
And then, yeah, in Bangladesh, they ask, have you had rice? As in, like, have you had a meal? Mm. So you can't have a meal without rice.
No.
I see.
Yeah.
Yes, in fact, I read that in Japan, the word gohan is the same for cooked rice and meal. So they're synonymous pretty much. Yeah.
It's such an important thing. There's actually, for us, qi, Q-I.
Oh, yeah.
Is the literal translation of it. Is like kind of vital energy and life force, so in traditional Chinese medicine. Mm. And those are made up in Mandarin of the characters for rice and steam.
Oh, wow.
I know.
There is no life without rice.
Rice has many other uses. As Rosie mentioned in the intro, you don't have to eat it. You can use it to make buildings, for instance.
Mm.
So in the Middle Ages, the Chinese, when they were building their Great Wall, they would use rice in the mortar to keep all the bricks together. So part of the Great Wall of China is built with rice.
Nice. And wow. That's, I think, read about this as well. It's particularly sticky rice.
Yes, obviously.
Yeah.
Time for our third lunchbox, and that's mine. So today I've brought you a steaming hot portion of duck. Whoa. In black bean sauce. With green peppers and onions served with rice.
Oh my God, heaven. Yeah. I love black bean sauce.
Mm-hmm.
It was my gateway into Chinese food.
I love this dish and I would order it every time I went to a Chinese restaurant. Basically, this dish sums up the symbiosis that ducks and rice have with each other. When you cultivate one, it's helpful to cultivate the other.
Oh, I was wondering what the link was going to be here because I was a bit like, this is nice, Jack, but you're not really talking about the rice. Also, I should say, very nicely cooked rice.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you.
I mean, the grains are perfectly separate. It's very well cooked.
So when you think of rice growing, you might have an image in your mind of the flooded rice field.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, imagine that it needs lots and lots of water and to be submerged in order to grow. But in actual fact, it doesn't need it at all. It can survive on the normal sort of rainfall that you would get from a regular dry field. The advantage it gains is that it can survive being submerged where other plants can't. Plants usually need air to their roots. It comes through the soil because it's not completely airtight, the soil. But when you have water covering it, these other plants, these normal plants, just drown, basically.
Mm.
Whereas rice gets oxygen in through its leaves, which are above the water, and sends it through special tubes down to its roots.
So that
all the weeds that could potentially steal some of its resources and, you know, grow over it and give it shade, they all die underwater, whereas rice can keep going and thriving.
That's so clever of rice.
Yeah, it's basically got its own like scuba pipe that other plants don't. And the advantage of rearing ducks with your rice crops is they can swim through the rice paddies and eat all the pests. And their swimming churns up the water, which gets, you know, keeps it from being stagnant. Mm-hmm. Their droppings contain lots of nutrients, which the rice use to grow. And they also float, unlike chickens. So you can keep the ducks on the same land that you're growing rice. 90% of the world's rice comes from Asia and 80% of the world's ducks, which is why you often see duck dishes with rice.
Oh, I see. That's crazy. I had no idea that they were so linked.
Yeah.
And I suppose because they're swimming, they're not disturbing or trampling. Trampling?
Trampling.
They're not trampling the crop. They're swimming delicately around it, making friends.
They can swim as indelicately as they like because the churn helps to keep the water from stagnating. So, yeah, it's an example of symbiosis in farmyards. It's not particularly natural, but it certainly works. So speaking of birds and pests and China, Chairman Mao, who was leader at the time, he wanted to boost crop yields. And so he had this great plan to eliminate the four main pests that he'd identified. And so he mobilized the citizens of China to destroy all the rats, fleas, mosquitoes, and alarmingly sparrows, poor things.
Oh, not the sparrows.
I know. They were eating some of the grain and the seeds. So in order to kill the sparrows, they were instructed to smash the nests, shoot them, poison them. Or one interesting way, which is a bit grim, is they would bang pots and pans so they would stay awake the whole time and drop dead of exhaustion.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh. Wouldn't that keep everyone else up as well?
Maybe sparrows need more sleep.
Yeah.
You could do it in shifts, I suppose.
Oh, fair. Still absolutely insane. The logic is...
But they were incentivized to, you know, bring one sparrow per household per week, which meant that mass hunts were much more aggressive.
Wow.
And it was a big mistake because ecological overreach is when they started killing all the sparrows, they didn't realize that the sparrows ate the locusts, which then boomed in numbers and ate even more of the crops. So they got in real trouble and caused a famine that killed millions of people.
Oh God.
Around 1960. But they quickly reversed that policy.
Yeah, in India when they had the great cobra, what was it?
Oh, the British Raj. Yeah, they tried to stamp out cobras, didn't they? Was it in Calcutta, maybe?
I think so. And they offered like a bounty for cobras. So if you brought them a dead snake, you get some money. But that just meant that people started breeding loads more cobras
so they could take farms.
Oh, it was mad. And I think a similar thing happened with rats as well in Vietnam. Like, it's such a bad policy. Do not pay people for dead animals.
But the cobra thing was compounded because then they realized what was the problem. And so they were like, okay, no more money. So then they just, suddenly these farms were worthless. So they just opened the gates and then they flooded the city with cobras. So it got worse.
My worst nightmare.
Really?
Not really. Like, I mean, I think my worst nightmare would be like a farm full of sharks, but
the shark farm.
But cobras aren't my favorite either, you know.
So interestingly, I've reheated the rice to serve you, which is actually it's a slight myth. Reheating your rice is not the inherently dangerous thing. So the reason it's become a bit of a myth is because what you shouldn't do, or you should minimize at least, is the amount of time the rice stays at room temperature. There is a thing, it's a bacterium called Bacillus cereus, which I think is quite funny. It's Bacillus cereus. And it is a serious problem. It can kill you if untreated, but it doesn't like it at cold or hot temperatures. So basically, when you cook rice and you have some leftovers, you shouldn't leave it on the side for a long amount of time. You should cool it down as quickly as you can, keep it in the fridge, and then when you reheat it, make sure that it's reheated to a piping hot temperature.
Yeah.
Rosie looks like she knows about this.
I mean, like, I've done food hygiene certificates level 3, if you're asking. And it's not quite the highest level, but it's a good level. I would say there's somewhat a hysteria, even in food hygiene circles, as it were. And food hygiene is obviously quite, like, alarmist, generally speaking. So... Mm-hmm. It's very protectionist. What I was taught was the rapid cooling means that it avoids the danger zone, which is the temperatures of 5 to 63 degrees Celsius.
Oh, really?
Wow, that's such a big 5 to 63.
Yeah. I mean, massive. Literally, the thing is that if we're all eating stuff that was sat on the counter for 2 hours, which we all do because we're just normal people, they're all in the danger zone. You're always running a risk, basically, right? But in industrial and hospitality food hygiene, that is the official danger zone. And when you reheat or when you cool down something, you have to record the temperature that it cooled down to and the time it took when you're keeping all of your safety records. So yeah, with rice, you cool it rapidly down and then you must reheat it also relatively rapidly. And it must reach a certain temperature. So I believe it's something like 70, 80 degrees. And that's one thing I should say about the reheating of rice is that I think one of the pitfalls of it is that it's actually super delicate to reheat. Like when you've cooked rice well, the grains will disintegrate if they're reheated very aggressively. But obviously you're being told you need to reheat it aggressively. So it can be kind of like a bit of a minefield.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes just better to make fresh rice in your fabulous rice cooker.
So that's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and any updates that we have. We're on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, all at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
That is right. We'll also be posting up any recipes we've mentioned on the website. Just head to qi.com/lunchbox to check them out.
Rosie, do you have any favourite recipes for rice in your new book?
Well, I have a risotto that I love. Ooh. Which is risotto alla milanese, which is saffron risotto.
Oh,
in my book, I serve it as a bed for ossobuco, which is braised veal shanks.
Oh.
It's a very classic dish from Milan. But saffron risotto is by far my favourite risotto.
Oh, yeah.
It's so deliciously good.
Oh, I'm going to make it tonight. We'll leave you with this. Famously, Rice Krispies go snap, crackle and pop, but that's only in English. If you go to France, they go crick, crack, crock. In Sweden, they go piff, paff, poff. And in German, they go knisper, knasma, knusper.
God. Oh, I love it.
Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Henriot, Rosie McKean, and me, Jack Chambers. It was mixed by Liang Lee and produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.
This is Danielle Fishel.
And Ryder Strong from Podmeets World.
When you have 5 and 7-year-old boys, I can promise you they love superheroes.
Oh, it never goes away. Indy is 11 years old and he's obsessed with comics, cartoons, video games, all of it.
Adler and Keaton both have Spider-Man costumes, and if anything says Marvel on it, they are in.
Same. Which is why we love Lingo Kids. They have Marvel Spider-Man activities that are totally age-appropriate.
And safe. Made just for the little ones.
Plus, Disney's Moana, Frozen, Zootopia, all the characters your kids already love, and a few you're secretly hoping they'll get into.
I just load up the iPads with Lingo Kids before a trip, and with over 4,000 interactive activities, songs, and shows, it keeps their attention for hours.
Download Lingo Kids for free or go all in with Lingo Kids Plus for even more incredible content.
Choose the yearly plan and save up to 60%. Search Lingo Kids in the App Store or Google Play.
Lingo Kids, everything kids love.